Okay, let's go.
When the out day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch special with Jersey Droz.
And it is a special, and it's been a while since I've done this show. It's been actually, I want to say 4 months since I've done this show. So welcome back to Thunder Punch Daily with a Thunder Punch special, everybody. I'm Jersey Droz of ComicsAreGreat.com, and sitting across from me in my studio is Mr. Richard Stevens of tunerfish.blogspot.com, yes?
That's correct. Yep, it's tuna with T-O-O, or as you Americans say, T-O-O-N-E-R, fish. And there's a hyphen between that tuna fish as well. So tuna-fish.blogspot.com.au. No, just .com, sorry.
.com.au.co.uk.
That's it. You'll find it.
.ca. So, yes, well, I'll link to you in the show notes. So you came to the United States for Kids Read Comics.
I did.
Came all the way from the Outback. Is that how you say it?
Close. Outback. Yes, yeah. I made the 13-hour flight from Sydney to LA, and then I think it was about a 4-hour flight from LA to here. So it was a very long trek, and it's one that I'm going to have to make again when I make my way back home, but it was well worth it.
Oh, not envying that, but I hope it was worth it, at least for the first part while you were here. Now, really quick, I'm going to give people a quick introduction to who you are and what you do. Let's see, you're a cartoonist, you're an animator. You worked on the Sugary Cereals project with me. You did The Elements of Destiny, which can be found at sugarycereals.com. You also do a comic/cartoon called Private Eye Butterfly. What's the status on that? What's going on with Private Eye Butterfly?
Yeah, it's probably going through a bit of a hiatus. I was experimenting with Flash. I was trying to see if I could make it more interactive and fun. I was sort of pushing the boundaries. It was becoming more of an animation than it was a comic. But the way things are sort of turning out, it looks as if Flash might be dying. HTML5 might be the way to go.
Yeah.
I'm actually considering to just sort of pull out of a lot of that stuff and just go back to my roots and just make it more of a comic that I can put into a printed form. Try not to make it so different and complicated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just sort of bring it back to inking and penciling and, yeah, going back to my basics where I really did enjoy it.
Back to your roots.
Mm.
But the big idea is that you are a fellow visual storyteller. Whatever kind of labels you want to throw on anything, you tell stories with images,
yep, right?
That's right? For a living and for fun.
Yep.
And so you came out to Kids Read Comics this year, and I was surprised to find out that this was your first time behind the table, actually exhibiting at a comic show, and I feel honored that my little show, I shouldn't say my show, the show that I helped put together was your first experience doing that. But I thought the reason I wanted to turn on the mics and record this was to get your take on, as a first-time exhibitor, you know, there's all these tutorials and there's all these blog posts and there's all this advice that gets kicked around about tabling at your first show. Here's the things to think about. And as we talked after your experience tabling at KRC, there were some things where I was coming at it feeling like this is something that there are certain things you have to learn the hard way. There's certain things you have to learn just by diving in and doing it, right? And I'm curious if we could just have a quick little talk on, from a first-time tabler's perspective, what are the things that you learned, the things that were surprising to you, things that you walked away with. I saw you type on Twitter, because you're Tunerfish on Twitter, too.
Mm-hmm.
You said, I want to go to another show. I want to do this again.
Yeah.
So obviously it was the big takeaway was it was a good experience, right? You enjoyed it?
Yep, absolutely. It was just great to be in a room of so many people with such great talent. And so friendly as well, so open and easy to approach, easy to talk to. But, the main sort of things that I walked away with, Josh Elder, he challenged me at one point. It was before the show had actually started, and he said, you have to explain to me in two sentences what it is that makes your comic so great.
Yeah.
Go.
And what did you do?
I just looked at him like a stunned mullet. I had no idea what to say.
A stunned mullet?
Oh, don't tell me that's a bit of Aussie slang that's coming through again.
I do not know what this is. You'll have to explain what a stun mullet is.
If you can imagine just a fish that's just stunned and not doing anything, that was me.
Okay. that's a good visual picture.
That's it, yeah. I mean, it wasn't because I didn't have anything to say about my comic. It was suddenly I had to try and put it all into one little nutshell that just sold it to the person that was on the other side of the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that was a bit of a challenge because it was something I'd never really thought of before. It was easier to just sit down, make a story, and it's there. And if you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But to try and sell it to another person, that was completely new to me. And
right.
So that was something that I learned, and I had no idea. It was all part of having a table. Yeah.
Now, I'll put this in the show notes too. Josh Elder is the guy behind readingwithpictures.org, and the man is a graduate course in salesmanship. When you watch that guy in action, the guy knows how to sell. And not in the kind of crass, foot in the door kind of salesman kind of thing, but he just understands how to speak to people to be able to convey what is important about the thing he's trying to get people excited about, right? And yeah, I mean, this is something I learned the hard way too, is like you have to distill it down to a couple sentences because you only got about 6 seconds before people are like, all right, I'm done.
Mm.
And this is another thing about, I mean, I'm hoping you could speak to this, is this is kind of like a writing exercise too, right? It's like I once was working with a friend on a project and I was trying to explain the motivation of the bad guy for the story we were working on. And I started going, oh, it's kind of like, he's kind of like this, but he's not like that. And he's a little bit of this, but he's a little bit of that. And I'm hemming and hawing, and I'm taking 10 minutes to tell him what it is that the bad guy is. And then finally, my writing partner on it looks at me and says, you really don't know what the bad guy is, do you? You know? And that succinct kind of description is also what goes into tight writing. Would you agree? Or I don't know if you can respond to that. Let me say this. Did that pitch make you think differently about writing?
Yeah, it did. It because when I was sitting there and I had that very much same experience, I had a parent was on the other side of the table, wanted to know what my comic was about. And I started getting into the sort of details about what it is that I liked about writing with these different characters and bouncing off each other. And they're realizing, hang on, I'm sort of going into way too much detail here when really he doesn't need to think about all that stuff. He just needs to know what the story is about.
Right.
So, yeah, it did make me think I've got to learn how to be able to summarize something that's so big in my mind into just that little snapshot that's enough to make the person want to pick it up and read more.
Right. Like, how do you explain to somebody why you love your mother?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you got 2 seconds.
Yeah. But I've got 30 years to explain it.
Right. That's what makes it so tough.
Yeah.
You know, and also like the thinking exercise that I found was like, okay, well, tell me what The Karate Kid is about. Like, what makes The Karate Kid good, right? You're not going to go, well, Daniel LaRusso is this boy who lives in this town. He's kind of poor. And then there's other kids who are rich and kind of snobby and they're mean to him. You don't go into all that detail. You just get to, it's this uplifting story about a young boy coming of age and with the help of a kindly old man learns the art of karate and thereby learns to be a man.
Mm,
there you go. That's the log line. That's the TV guide pitch.
Yep.
So
I think that's definitely worth sitting down and writing on, say, a little card or just something like that to use when you are sitting at that table and you just need to give them that quick snapshot. Yep.
Did you find that you got closer to that quick snapshot over the course of the weekend?
Yeah, actually, I had to sit down and read my comic real quickly again, just because I wrote it back in 2007, and of course, right. A lot has happened since then.
Sure.
And there I am with this comic that I went, oh, hang on, is my understanding of, you know, because I've shaped something in my mind for the last whatever it's been since 2007. What's that? I need to do my maths. 5 years? Yeah. So, yeah, I had to quickly look at it. And even because it was written to be like a Saturday morning cartoon series, that's what a lot of the Sugary Cereals comics were all about.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I had that first page to explain a bit of the story in that one page.
That's
it was
right.
Like the opener of a cartoon series.
That's right. Yeah, all of the contributors. For those who haven't read Sugary Cereals before, all of the contributors were encouraged to create a 1 to 2 page sort of introduction, the intro music to the show, as it were. Right. Mm. So in He-Man, I'm Prince Adam. Prince of Eternia and Guardian of the Secrets of Castle Grayskull, and he goes through everything you need to know in the first 30 seconds. Everything you need to know in order to enjoy the show that's coming up. Right.
Yep.
So that itself was like an exercise in developing your log line, as they call it in writing talk and screenwriting talk, I think. But yeah, okay, that's a big one. And that's one that I learned the hard way too. And I was first tabling was people come up like, what's this about? And I'd go, well, it's kind of about this, kind of about that. And then they're gone. So
yeah, and there's another point as well. I'd never seen The Last Airbender. And when I started watching it, I actually found similarities between that show and this comic that I had made. And that really sort of, it made things a bit more difficult for me because I wanted to be able to turn this person and say, this is something that's unique, it's fun and everything. But in the back of my mind, I was fearing that this person's going to hear what the story's about and go, oh, but that sounds a lot like The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
Now, that was also thrown into the mix.
Yeah.
I don't know how to really combat that, whether it's worth researching more when you come up with a story and just seeing what else is out there and making sure. I don't know. What's your take on that, Jersey?
Well, this is something I tell my students all the time in my comics classes is, okay, I'm going to tell you, so you're familiar with my work. You know, you've read the front.
Yep.
I'm going to tell you the plot of The Lord of the Rings. There's this little young man. He's very alone and special. And along comes this old guy who says, oh, you're even more alone and special than you thought. And there's this ancient old guy who's going to try to get you because of that special thing that you have, that thing that makes you very unique. And we'll surround you with some magical people who are going to support you to keep you safe from this evil old guy. But ultimately, the magical characters can only take you so far. And that final stretch of the story, you're going to have to make yourself, and you're going to have to make that difficult decision on your own. That's Lord of the Rings. That's also The Front, right?
Yeah.
The Front Rebirth, my first graphic novel. And so I have no problems with that. At the time when I was doing the book, I was terrified that, especially because like when I was starting work on the webcomic, the Lord of the Rings films were just coming out. And I thought, oh, everybody's going to call me out on this. Everybody's going to, you know, see that I'm a complete fraud and I just ripped off from Tolkien or whatever. But in the end, A, nobody called me out on it. And B, there's such a thing as, you know, you're dealing with timeless and classic ideas. You know, if there's similarities in structure, if there's even similarities in like subject matter or even in like some surface features. The thing is that I've read Elements of Destiny. I've watched all of the Avatar shows that are out so far. There's some superficial similarities, but ultimately, even if you were given the Avatar The Last Airbender story, you would not execute it the same way that the writers of that series did. So it's still going to be idiosyncratic to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I haven't watched enough of Avatar to really understand or even know, sorry, what the full story is. I've only seen one episode. I was watching it going, oh, no, I'm watching all these characters manipulate the four basic elements, as I call them. So, yeah, it was really that sort of maybe surface value to the two stories that, for me, seemed similar.
Sure. Well, and another thing I could point out is there was a comic series in the late 80s, early 90s called Elementals by Bill Willingham. And it was about four superheroes who represented each of the Western idea of the four elements, earth, fire, air, and water. I mean, it's not like that's like such a, it's not like that's never been done, right?
Yeah.
It's like, so the thing I try to tell, you know, beginning and young students is that everything's been done. All you can bring to it is your spin. And as a matter of fact, it's like, okay, here's a jag I've gone on a million times on Thunder Punch Daily and on the other shows I've done. Somebody says, I want to do something truly original. If you do it truly original, nobody's going to know how to read it because it's going to be so outside of human experience that it won't be entertaining at all. It'll be incomprehensible to other human beings, right? You have to find those common similar grounds in order to be able to convey your ideas, right? So my attitude these days is I don't worry about it that much, but you know, early on when I was first starting in comics work, I was like striving really hard to find that original spin to everything. Mm. But sometimes the original spin is your look at it, right?
Yep.
So any other observations that you walk away from tabling for the first time?
Mm. Definitely presentation with the table. Mine was a pretty basic presentation. I have to admit, if I'd sort of known about it a lot sooner because we did sort of have a bit of miscommunication with being on the other side of the world. I believe it was an email was sent out to say that everyone gets a table, but I was of the opinion, oh no, I don't need a table. I'm only doing the workshops.
Yeah.
And then I got here and I've got a table. So we were able to pull something together, but we didn't put as much work into the presentation of this table as I would have liked. But I did happen to notice that because mine was a pretty basic presentation, it did affect the way that people would approach or even walk past my table when they were going from one table to the next. They sort of just looked over it, and then they looked at the guy next to me who's got the banners and the stands and all the workers there. And then they sort of just got gravitated over to that table next to me. They even had sort of some kids looking at it, not too sure how to take it. And, mm-hmm. I picked up a comic and I reached out and I said, "Do you want to have a read of this? Do you want to have a look?" And the kid opened up the comic and then he was, oh, okay, this isn't this isn't what I was expecting.
Yeah.
So there is that whole sort of judge a book by its cover, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I guess the same can be said for tables. If you want to sort of grab their attention and then you've got their attention, have that snapshot to explain what the story is about. And I was noticing that at a lot of the tables too. I had a chance to get up and look around and even go to those tables of the big name, I'll call them artists, that I really wanted to see and meet. And it was funny as well because in some cases there were some people who were doing the sales pitch for them. And I had to sort of go, no, you don't even have to worry about the sales pitch. I can tell that this is good.
Right.
Yeah.
But see, that's where you're different. I mean, this is something Dave Roman has sort of drilled into me a little bit is we're the weird ones because we are the creators of the stuff. So we are not the typical reader. Like I had a discussion with him, I think it was on Comics Are Great, where we were talking about how I asked the question, well, weren't you the kids who went to the comic store and were looking for what was new? And Dave said, but we're the weird kids. We were the kids who wanted to be cartoonists. So, of course, we hunted for the next novel thing. But the average reader, the average, like, you know, the pure comics reader who doesn't have any interest in actually making comics, they're going to gravitate towards whatever brands they recognize, characters they recognize. They're going to go towards what's the familiar. They're not necessarily going to be people who are hunting for what's new and going, like, and ready to walk up to a stranger and say, tell me about your thing, right? So... For you, that sales pitch was moot. You didn't need to do it, right? It's like I see Reed Gunther. I think it was it Reed Gunther you picked up?
Yep.
By Chris Houghton. Fantastic book. You can tell right from looking at it. It's a great book. But to the average person walking by, Reed Gunther, I've never heard of it, right? So he's got to do that pitch. Now, this is where I think you did a good thing is that but by actually reaching out to kids and saying, would you like to have a read of this? Crack it open.
Yeah.
Good for you for having that kind of self-awareness and self-confidence to be able to actually reach out to strangers because most people, I mean, you've told me about this at some other shows in your neck of the woods. Mm. The artists just sit there like looking down at the table and sketching and not interacting with people, even when you try to interact with them, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's another point that I guess I'd already had in my mind when I went into it, but definitely one that I took away from the experience is that it really pays to just pay attention to who's approaching a table and just be ready and open and have a smile on your face and just make it a good experience for that person as opposed to because they've made the step to come up to my table and for me to just be sketching on my pad and just look up and go, hey, it's not very inviting.
What's up? Yeah.
No, that doesn't make a young person want to walk up to you. It depends on your audience, I guess. I mean, if like you're, I guess in certain circles, going like "What's up?" is a very warm greeting to some people. Yeah, but yeah, and I've found that you know sometimes when I'm engaged with people, I'll do my like "Hey" kind of thing, and some people don't want to hear that.
I came across that too. It's like, oh, you're a bit too overconfident for me. It's okay. I'll tone back. I'll just sit back down.
I don't like smiles. But okay. But going back to table display, I mean, what would you do different? I mean, because we could just describe what you had. You had the books. Mm-hmm. I mean, thank goodness for computer backups because we were able to pull up all the files of your books and quickly send them to the local copy shop to get some mini comics printed, and then a poster printed. So you did have a spread on the table. What would you try different at the next show that you do?
Yeah. That's something that it was sort of going through my mind. Does it pay to keep everything at a low point? By that I mean when you've got your table, do you want to have everything much like, you know, how a kid's going through a cereal aisle in a shopping center? I don't know if you ever noticed, but they usually keep the cereals that the kids want to go for. They keep it at that low level where the kids can see it, they can reach for it and everything. So it leaves me wondering, does it pay to have everything at that low point where they can easily reach for it and everything, or does it pay to have the big banner up above eye level, that sort of thing? It's something that I guess I need to do a bit more research in, but I'm curious to know what's your findings on that, Jersey?
I found it's 6.5. What is it? How's that saying go? Like 6 in one hand, half a dozen in the other, something like that. It's like it's a little bit of both. I found that I've tried both things, where I elevate everything up high, and I'll notice that half of the people walking by my table don't want to make eye contact necessarily. Mm-hmm. And if you put things up high, that's drawing them to make eye contact with you.
Yep.
And so I'll have all this stuff, 6 feet up in the air, 3 meters, as you would say, up in the air. Or no, 2 meters. 2 meters, not three. I'm getting my maths wrong. I'll have it up that high, and I'll notice that people don't look at it because they want to keep their eyes down on the table, and they want to make the judgment of whether they want to engage with me based on what they see on the table first. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So like they see like, oh, this book looks good. Now I'll look at the guy.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I notice that when I'll keep everything low, and I'll keep everything at, a child's eye level, I'll notice people looking at me first and then not looking at my stuff on the table, and I got to direct them down there. So I haven't really, I probably don't do enough shows to report on this. And I think it depends on the show. It depends on the audience. It depends on who you're trying to reach.
Yep.
But I do find that if you're doing kids stuff, having stuff low, like you said, really helps. When I did some art fairs here in Michigan over the last couple of years, when I have my sugary cereal stuff down low where the kid can see it, and I'll have it cover, like I'll have it standing up, like I won't have it flat on the table, but I'll have the cover sort of like resting against like a stand, so that it's just about eye level for like a 10-year-old. Then I get a lot of good reactions out of kids when they catch that exciting cover with all the colors and everything. But I see friends of mine who are, have completely different audiences, maybe something aimed more at adults. They'll rig up like a big stand that goes sort of like forms a frame around them, around the table. And that's the guys who were next to you. They kind of had that. They had these boxes, these wire mesh boxes that stacked so they could get it up to like, 8-9 feet tall.
Sorry. And I just remembered something else as well. I kept the sugary cereals comics there as a sample for them, just so that I could say, okay, this is where the story has come from. Mm-hmm. This is where it was originally published. You can buy these online. And that was another thing too, because when I mentioned you can buy these online, some people went, oh, yeah, I can buy it online, can I? Okay, and then they walked off.
See you later. Yeah.
There was that, and there was also, I noticed when the kids were looking at what was there on the table, they went straight for the Sugary Seals comics because of those colors, because of what was really catching their eye. Yeah.
So
my cover for my comic, it probably was a bit duller or darker in with the colors when compared to those Sugary Seals comics.
And we should say that these Sugary Seals comics featured your art on the covers.
Yeah.
Right? So like there was one in particular, I think it was issue 7, that was had the cover on that.
Yeah.
But I think the branding with like the star pattern, like if anybody's ever seen the Sugary Seals covers, they have like this frame around the artwork with stars traveling around the frame, and then like the big bold colorful logo, Sugary Cereals. That I do find that branding 10-year-old kids respond to it very, very well. So,
and not to mention familiarity, I can't even say the word, the word familiarity.
Yeah.
I sometimes stumble with it. I'm not very familiar with the word.
Anyway.
Yeah, but for them to look at those Sugary Seals, the magazines, basically, they were like magazines. They were professional comic books, and they were able to look at that and straight away know what it was, as opposed to something that I had run through a photocopying center.
The covers still looked good, though. I mean, they were full-color, glossy covers. We only had one night to turn them around, and we looked at the unit cost on printing a full-color 24-page book, and what it was going to be, like $7 a unit. Mm. And what are you going to sell them for? Are you going to sell them at a loss? Are you going to sell them at three? Because you can't sell a 24-page black, even a color book for less than $5 and expect to move any.
Yeah.
So, you would have been looking at $14 for a 24-page book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you still sold, right?
Surprisingly, I sold more than 50% what was printed. Yeah,
that's not bad.
And your wife, your lovely wife, was telling me that that's a very good thing to be selling more than 50% of what's on display. Yeah,
in my experience, it is. I mean, but I don't have name recognition. I don't go to shows. People don't walk up to me and go like, "Oh, Jersey Droz, thank God you're here."
Yeah.
One person maybe, but. But for the most part, yeah, I don't have that name recognition thing to back me up. Yeah. So,
actually, that's a very good point about putting a name to your work and also a face to your work.
Yeah.
I was talking to, I think it was Diana Knock. Knock, is it?
Yeah.
Yep. And I handed her a comic to do a bit of a swap with. And straight away when she looked at the comic, she said, "Oh, you're that Richard Stevens." So yeah, I mean, like with your site, for instance, you've got your work there, you've got your podcasts, you've got your YouTube videos. You're basically putting a face to your work.
Yeah.
But for me, I might put it online, but I might do a little caricature, a drawn caricature of myself, but I don't really put my face or a voice to my work.
Right.
And I mean, it pays to go to conventions or events like this, and I can say, "Hey, I am the Richard Stevens behind this comic," and I can get myself known that way. But yeah, that was another thing that I noticed as well, because I had to. Not only am I from Australia, but I also had to explain to people I am Richard Stevens and I am the one who worked on this. So yeah, so that people could associate me with. Something that they are familiar with. Yeah.
Sure. So did you wind up, I mean, because this is another thing we talked about over lunch the other day, how there's never enough time to visit every table in an artist's alley. I mean, even Kids Read Comics, which is a comparatively small show, it's still tough to find the time all week in between tabling and then running workshops to visit with everybody there and have any kind of meaningful interaction.
Yep.
But you still made the effort to do so, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure it was partially because this is, you know, a rare opportunity. You're in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You're tabling for the first time. But, you know, they're going back to the thing we were alluding to earlier with cartoonists who sit behind the table and just sketch and don't interact.
Yep.
Do you think it's important for a cartoonist to get out and actually do that FaceTime with other fellow cartoonists there?
I think so. I mean, I especially love doing it. I just love networking. I love meeting people who have great talent. And people who are well on their way to improving on their talent. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I think it does pay to have that connection with the people around you. It just makes the experience a lot more fun. You don't feel like you're just sitting there and waiting for the next person to come to your table. That's for sure. You can get chatting with the person next to you, and the time just flies by. And it does to pay to do that networking online as well, and just. You've got people that you can talk to. You've got people that you can show your work to. They can give you advice. You can do the same in return.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Yep.
And I'm going to be the guy listening who goes, "Well, how do you start that conversation? I don't know how to walk around and just engage with people."
Yeah.
I can walk up and say, like, "Hey, is this your comic?"
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how do you do that? I mean, how do you walk around and like forge these connections?
Yeah, is this as a person who's A, worked on a comic, or B, has a table at the same event?
Yes, I'm tabling for the first time and I want to make those connections. And how do I do it?
Yeah, I found the greatest icebreaker was just saying, "Hey, I've got a table over there." And straight away there is a an attitude shift of, "Oh, you're just not someone who's wanting to look at my work. You're a fellow artist. You're someone who's on the same level as me. You're experiencing what I'm experiencing here today." That was the greatest icebreaker for me.
Interesting, because I would assume that their attitude would change in the sense of, "Oh, I just lost the sale. Now I'm not interested in talking to you."
Okay.
"Oh, you're a poor cartoonist like I am."
Maybe it's because at the same time I was just drooling over their work ready to buy something. So. And I must admit, I spent a lot of my profits on other people's work.
I do the same thing every year. Every time I go to SPX, the last day of the show, I walk the entire artist alley and spend a half to three quarters of what I made that weekend buying other people's work. So, so you think engaging on the level of saying I'm a tabler as well is a good way to sort of begin, sort of establish that trust with them, that you're not just some rabid fan, but you're also on the same level as them, to whatever degree.
Yeah, because I found that their reaction was also, "Oh, whereabouts? What have you worked on? What have you got here to show me today?" That, you know, and there was something new to me as well that I discovered, that artists will be happy to swap a comic with my comic. I had to stop someone because I said, "No, yours is a full trade paperback that you've spent a lot of money on printing. Mine's just something that I had to do on the fly."
Yeah.
"You don't want to swap with mine." This is before they even saw it.
Oh, okay.
But surprisingly, some of them were like, "No, I want to swap with your comic. I want to do that
That's
exchange."
Cool.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Mm.
Every once in a while, though, you will run into somebody who's like, "Oh, they'll do that comparison, not even of like the art quality, but also like the just the printing quality, yeah, right? Or the length, right? So if I've got an 8-page mini and somebody's like, oh, you want to trade, and they've got like a 200-page graphic novel, they're gonna look at my trade and go, hey, come on, but that's cool that people at Kids Read Comics were ready to trade anyway. But that is half of the fun, is that trading and then networking. And then I noticed another thing you did was you were careful to grab Twitter handles from everybody, right? Yep. So after the show, like the day after, I was watching my Twitter feed and it was like you just saying, great meeting you at this thing. Hey, awesome talking to you.
Yep.
You know?
That's another thing as well I've walked away with, because what I was doing was every time I was meeting these artists, I didn't actually ask for all their details. They had business cards that already had those Twitter accounts and websites and everything. So I was just pinching their business cards and then just went back to the place that I was staying at and just started going ad with all these Twitter accounts that I had. But I would have loved to have had something like that as well, a little business card that I can give to them in return. It was all right because I could add them and then they could go, oh, you're that guy, and then you respond to it sort of thing.
Yeah. But you made sure to follow up like 24 hours later, right? Yep. Within a 24-hour period, you were following up so that memory was fresh in their mind, so they're not going like, who's that again?
Yeah,
exactly. I'm the guy who said this thing to you. They're not going to remember that necessarily because they talked to hundreds of people that day,
right? That's right. I was the Australian, so I stood out.
That's true. That's true. You do, yes, that's what Seth Godin calls the purple cow. You were the purple cow there. You were the one who stood out because you had the exotic accent.
Yes.
But no, I just ordered a new batch of business cards, and I finally put my Twitter handle on there thinking, like, yeah, that's a good idea. Everybody's using that now. So they're not necessarily going to go to my website and go, where's his Twitter feed? Right, so just by simply putting @Jersey on there, now people can quickly follow me back, kind of thing. Any other thoughts, wonderings, observations, takeaways that come out of this? Anything you would tell anybody else? That this is somebody who's, I want to go to a show. I'm ready to invest in this thing. You spend a lot of money to do this, right? Yep. I mean, that's another one. That's no secret. It's expensive to do a convention, even one with three tables, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're traveling across the globe. But any other things that you would throw at somebody who's like got a table for the first time that, was hard-won knowledge?
Maybe go to a convention as a, not as someone who's got a table, but just go to a convention as another visitor and just have a good look at what you think works, what you can see people are doing, and even talk to artists yourself, get that experience as to what it's like to be on the other side of the table. And like for instance, because I was talking to artists, or tried to talk to artists that were sitting there just looking down at their sketch pad, I learned from that I don't want to do that to other people. So be in their shoes, and then like as in the person who's visiting the table, and then maybe do that before you go having your own table. Apart from that, probably everything that I've covered with the sort of stuff that I've learned when it comes to promoting yourself and having enough stuff there to say, this is who I am and this is what I do.
I love this idea of going to a convention with an intentionality behind, like a research intentionality. Not just going and going, where's the cool toys? Where's the cool books? Oh, is there a movie screening going on? I mean, that's all fun, but also being observant of, why did I go to that guy's table and not that guy's table, right? What was different? Was it the way he looked at me? Was it the way he talked to me? Was it something about the display? Really have an observant eye and take notes on how you're reacting as an attendee rather than as a guest, right?
That's right.
So, yeah, I think that's a terrific idea, and that's something that I should be more aware of when I'm at shows, is when I'm going around and buying stuff at the different tables at the end of the weekend. Why did I buy this and not that, right?
Yep.
So, cool. Well, anything that you wanted to point people at, Richard, for anybody who's interested in following up more about your stuff and finding out where you're going to be next?
Okay, yep. I'll say that I've got my website. It's, again, TunaFish. That's TOONERFish. .com.au. That's my main website. That should have everything on it. So
it
should be links to Twitter, to the blog, everything. So there should be enough there. And also you can look for The Art of Richard Stevens on Facebook if you prefer.
You have a Facebook page.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep.
That's where to follow up with you.
Yeah.
So do you have your eye on the next show you're going to do?
No, I don't. I want to have a good look at what is actually in Australia, because I can't afford to come here.
Yeah,
every so often, as much as I'd love to, because I had an absolutely awesome time at Kids Read Comics.
Thank you
and the other co-organizers for that one, because it was a great experience, especially as a first tabler.
Oh, I'm just glad that we could provide that. But yeah. But thank you for that. Okay, well, then we'll anybody who wants to follow up with you can go to your website, and then we'll have to have you on the Comics Great Show one of these days, although it'll be in the middle of the night your time. Mm. But I'll wait till you're acclimated back to Australian time when we do that.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon, or I'll be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily. And until then, remember, everybody.
In today's story, Skeletor was looking for a shortcut, a quick way to riches and power. You may know some people like that, always looking for the quick way to get ahead of everybody else. Well, it doesn't work that way. The people who succeed are the ones who work for what they want. So don't be fooled by those who say they have a sure thing. There's always a catch to it. Don't sell yourself short. The right way is the best way. Until later.